Chapter 5. The month of Nisan drew to a close. It was the time of the first harvest. On the slopes at the foot of the mountain, the villagers, men and women and children, moved slowly through the fields of barley, the long hairy heads of grain falling in rhythmic waves before their sickles. From the mountain lookout, Rosh's men watched them, speculating from which unguarded field they might snatch their own due share. Daniel, who had never before been discontented with a mountain springtime, felt restless. He chafed at the days of heavy labor required to make one inferior sword. He yearned for the day when they could cease to make swords and could at last put them to use. He was impatient with Rosh's waiting. Every day, Rosh's spies brought news of caravans passing on the roads below. When the men least expected it, Rosh would give sudden orders, and there would be a spurt of furious activity. Then Daniel would hurl himself into the short battle with all the fury he longed to expend on the Romans. Afterwards, he always felt let down. What had been gained? Was the day actually any nearer? That night, on the rooftop of his grandmother's house, he had seen so clearly that all he longed and hoped for was here in Rosh's band. Now it seemed to him that most of the men did not really care, that they were just as bad as the villagers who thought no further than the next meal. He roamed the trails often in the hope of meeting again the boy who had climbed up from the village, though he knew that by now Joel Bar Hezron must be living in the big house in Capernaum. He and the village boy had been drawn together by a common dream, and for a few moments Joel had been very close to giving up everything he possessed to join Rosh's band. Perhaps if he had had another chance. Joel was the sort Rosh needed, impatient, full of spirit, not afraid to take a risk. Slowly, a daring plan began to form in Daniel's mind, and when he had mulled it over for several days, he summoned his courage and took it to Rosh. Rosh heard him out, his button-black eyes twinkling with derision. "Ever been to the city of Capernaum?" he inquired. "No," said Daniel. "Still, I'd like to try. I'm sure I could find him." Rosh considered. "Go ahead," he said finally. "You can look after yourself, but don't set your heart on that boy. He's got too much to lose. I checked on him. Grandfather was rich as old Hezekiah himself. But go along. He might be useful to us in Capernaum." Daniel set off long before dawn, carrying the cloak Simon had given him. Leaving Samson was easier this time. The big man understood that he would come back. The dark trails held no terror. His feet knew every jutting rock and turn. With the first light, he left the mountain behind and strode along the level road through the plain. In the east, a yellow glow began to gather, sending out long spears of pink and pale amethyst. From the olive groves came the song of a lark, rising to a thin, clear sweetness against the pearly sky. On every side sounded the urgent chirping of linnets and finches. Abruptly, the sun burst forth. Daniel could see a golden field of mustard stretching as far as his eye could reach, the yellow blossoms so high that a man could walk through them unseen. Presently, he overtook a caravan. Prodded on by weary drivers, the camel swayed slowly. Above the smell of camel, Daniel's nose caught an unfamiliar fragrance, sweet and spicy, which seeped from the toppling bags they carried. As the day grew brighter, the road was busy with farmers trundling small wagons or bearing on their shoulders baskets of vegetables for the city market. Already, the excitement of the city quickened his pulse. He came out on the last long slope of the road. Below him lay the sea, like a great blue jewel in the sun, and at its edge the town of Capernaum, a mass of dark stone houses, thick clustered. A transparent veil of mist and smoke hung over the rooftops. He fancied he could hear the hum of thousands of voices. He hurried on, forgetting the miles behind, feeling fresh and exhilarated. It was far too early to look for Joel, but he was in no haste. There was much to see. He wandered through the streets, taking in great gulps, the busyness, the color, and sound and smell of them. In the marketplace, the farmers were heaping squashes and cucumbers and melons, and merchants jabbered in outlandish tongues as they set up booths of cloth or baskets or pottery. He saw four elders of the Pharisees, the phylacteries bound to their proud foreheads, walking with great care that their tasseled robes did not brush the passers-by, lest the merest touch might make them unclean. Once he saw a black slave scurrying about his master's business. Did he, if Daniel could understand, speak the same language as Samson? He came to the harbor and gazed at the multitude of boats, fishing dories, and pleasure craft, and flat-bottomed barges. Back and forth from the anchored barges moved an unending line of half-naked men, bearing on their backs the sacks of grain and baskets of fruit which the farmers had brought to the city. So this was where the food went that was borne away day after day from his own village. All this to feed the evil city of Tiberias, which Herod had built to the south and named for the emperor of Rome. Daniel was reminded suddenly of his own empty stomach, and he remembered that although Rosh had been free enough with his advice, he had not provided a single copper with which to buy food. Further along the shore, where the fishing boats were drawn up, the fishermen were dragging in their night's catch, the great nets heaving and gleaming in the sun. Women had come down to meet them, and were spreading the fish on flat stones and sprinkling them with salt. Others stretched out the empty nets to dry. Above the smell of fish, Daniel detected a tantalizing odor, and saw that several of the families had lighted small fires and were preparing their breakfast. "Hungry boy?" Daniel started, abashed to be caught staring. A smiling young woman in a bright red and blue headdress was holding out a small fish on a palm leaf. He backed away. "I have no money," he muttered. "Who said anything about money? You can see there's plenty. Take it." The fish was delicious, the skin smoky and crisp. The woman eyed him admiringly. "Where would a handsome stranger like you have come from?" she demanded. Embarrassed, he stammered the name of Ketza. "Are you waiting for the teacher?" she inquired. "No." "You should, then. It's worth being late for." "What teacher?" he asked. "The carpenter." "Ah, there he is now," she called over her shoulder to another woman. "Come, he's about to begin." Daniel turned curiously. A short way from them on the shore, a cluster of fishermen had gathered, and from all sides others were leaving their nets. A few workers broke from the lines that labored on the barges. Through the shifting bodies, Daniel caught a glimpse of the man in their midst. It was the man who had spoken in the synagogue. He stood on the beach among the fishing boats, in his plain white robe, smiling and greeting the men by name. Out here in the sun, he did not look solemn as in the synagogue. He looked vigorous and confident and happy. Something he was saying drew a burst of laughter from the men. Daniel pushed his way nearer till he could get a good look. "How strong he is," he thought. Yet bodily, the man was no match for the sturdy fishermen who surrounded him. The impression of strength came from an extraordinary vitality that seemed to pulse in the very air around him. Once more, as on that day in the synagogue, Daniel felt a spark leap up in his own body. Looking about him, he could see the same spark reflected in the eyes of the men and women who jostled him. Someone shouted a question that Daniel could not catch, and Jesus held up a hand to ask their silence. "What is the kingdom of heaven?" he answered. "It is like a merchant in search of fine pearls, who, on finding one pearl of great value, went and sold all that he had and bought it. Or the kingdom of heaven is like a net which was thrown into the sea and gathered fish of every kind." A clink of metal distracted Daniel. Turning, he saw that two soldiers had joined the crowd. They sauntered close and stood looking with curiosity at the speaker and his audience. Automatically, Daniel spat. Two fishermen glared at him. Plainly, they resented his disturbance more than they did the presence of the soldiers. One of the Romans shot him a quick, contemptuous glance. Jesus took no notice whatsoever. He could not have missed their tall helmets, yet his calm voice did not falter. Anger spiraled up in Daniel. He didn't want to hear any more. The nearness, the arrogance of those two choked him. He turned his back on them and walked away. Yet he could not escape the sight of Roman soldiers. They stood on the docks, counting off bales of wheat and vegetables. They strolled through the marketplace. Everywhere, the Jews went about their business, paying no attention. The boy who had lived for 5 years in the solitude of the mountain, nursing his hatred and keeping it ever fresh, could not credit his own eyes. How could these city's people endure to be reminded on every hand of their own helplessness? More shameful still, He saw merchants joking with the soldiers. He could not understand. Where was their pride? Had they forgotten altogether? If Rosh were here, he would open their eyes. Why did that Jesus do nothing? At the thought of Rosh, he was reminded of the reason he had come to the city. It took him some time to find the house of Rabbi Hezron. Finally, someone directed him up the steep hill that rose above the harbor. As he climbed the cobbled street, his stomach began to clamor. He had counted on Joel to observe the unwritten law that provided that any stranger who came to one's door must receive food and shelter. But as the crowded stone dwellings gave way to the long, forbidding walls of large estates, and he caught glimpses of gardens and terraces rising, one upon another, green and golden, he felt his first doubt. Rosh had warned him that Hezron had inherited great wealth, but Daniel had no acquaintance with wealth. He had not been prepared for the hugeness of it. Would such houses as these remember the law of hospitality? Or would they turn him away like a beggar? He came to the heavy door in the wall to which he had been directed, and rang the bell that hung there. After some time, the wooden door creaked open, and a wizened man peered out at him. Hezron? In the nick of time, he noticed that the man's ears had been pierced. He had almost made a fool of himself and bowed to a slave. "I have come to speak with Joel Bar Hezron," he answered much too loudly. With reluctance, the servant allowed him to step into a narrow tiled corridor. "You will wait here," he said. "What name shall I give to the young master? Tell him it is Daniel Bar Jamin, a friend from Ketzah." The hallway where he waited was cool and dim, the oaken doors that led from it all closed. Through the open archway opposite him, Daniel stared with astonishment into a sunlit courtyard, at flowering trees and green borders and white marble. His ears caught the gentle splash of water and the trilling of birds. He had not dreamed that even Herod's palace could boast such wonders. What a fool he had been to think that Joel would even remember him. There was a soft footstep, a rustle of silk, and a shadow fell between him and the sunlit opening. It was not Joel who stood there, but his sister, Malthace. A robe of thin, soft material fell in exquisite folds to delicate, embroidered sandals. Her dark hair was bound back from her face with a thin fillet of gold. She started at sight of a stranger, and there leaped into her eyes recognition and then something else, an unmistakable shrinking. His careful greeting fell back to his own feet. She made no greeting at all, only stared at him with dismay. Then there was a thumping of feet. The boy who came charging across the courtyard had not changed at all. He was the same country boy who had jumped into the fight on the mountain road. He grasped Daniel by the elbows, his dark eyes glowing. "Daniel, welcome! I've been wishing..." He broke off with a quick glance over his shoulder. "You'll stay to eat with us? Of course you will." Pride battled with Daniel's clamoring stomach. "No," he said, "I came only to speak with you." "You're certainly not going right away, after all this time." "My clothes are dusty from the road."
"Oh, that! Just leave your cloak here in the hallway, for father's sake, you know."
Daniel flushed, remembering that a common man who visited a Pharisee must leave his cloak at the door, lest he make the household unclean. Slowly, he undid Simon's coat, allowed Joel a glimpse of the torn and scanty garment beneath. "Never mind," Joel said hastily. "Better wear it after all. It doesn't matter, really." Propelling his guest along the corridor, Joel was all at once aware of his sister, who still stood just inside the archway. "Thaisha," he said, an uncertain note in his voice. "Do you remember Daniel, the one who..." He floundered to a stop. Her fine dark eyebrows lifted. "I remember," she said, in a cool, light voice. Then she turned on her embroidered sandal and walked away from them. Joel looked after her with annoyance, then he shrugged. "Don't mind Thaisha," he said. "She's putting on city airs lately. Come, we'll go up to my room where we can talk. If you knew what it's like to see someone from home..." Daniel had to follow so rapidly through the courtyard that he had only a blurred impression of green beauty. They passed beneath a row of slender columns into another corridor, up a flight of shallow steps, and into a small square room. Apparently, Joel slept in this room and did not even have to share it with anyone.
There was a single low couch with a striped linen covering, two carved wooden benches, a painted chest, and a desk with quills and an inkpot and a scroll propped open as though Joel had just been working on it. Joel poured water from a fine pottery jar and laid out a smooth linen towel. Self-consciously, Daniel washed his hands and feet and retied his turban. It was plain that Joel did not care whether he was respectable or not, that the boy was overjoyed to see him. Daniel's wiry self-confidence reasserted itself. He would not let himself be shaken again by a silly girl. "Did Rosh send you?" Joel demanded. "Have you held up any more caravans? How about the slave, the big black one? I didn't envy you when you let him off that day."
"I should have kept my mouth shut," Daniel answered.
"What happened?" "The minute I took his chains off, he took charge of me instead. He's made me the laughing stock of the camp. He works like a mule to keep my fire going, but he won't let me out of his sight."
Joel was amused at the picture. "Can he talk? Does he understand what you say?"
"The others don't think so. I'm not sure. Sometimes it seems as though he's trying to tell me something."
"You're not afraid of him?"
"Not for myself, but I have to watch him all the time. That strength of his, it's like a rock on the edge of the cliff. A feather could start it down. One night I got into an argument with Jockton, and Jock started at me with his fists. I looked up just in time. There was Samson reaching for Jock with those great arms of his. It was all I could do to stop him."
Joel whistled. "I should think," he began, when a chiming gong interrupted him, and he rose to his feet.
"Father insists that we're on time for meals," he said. "We'd better talk later." Near the fountain in the courtyard, Hezron stood waiting, a tall, narrow-faced man with graying hair. He bowed with a cool courtesy at Joel's introduction.
"Peace be with you," he said.
"You are welcome." He gazed with distaste at Daniel's unlawful garment. "A camel would be as welcome," Daniel thought. "The man will have to purify his whole house when I leave." Side by side, two women moved gracefully across the tile pavement, Malthace and an older woman who must once have looked much like her daughter. A tiny bird of vivid blue darted from a dwarf pear tree and lighted for a breath's space on the girl's shoulder, then flashed away. The corner of Thaisha's mouth curled slightly as she looked at Daniel, hinting, "I could tell them much if I cared." The mother smiled warmly and held out her hand to him. They led Daniel through an archway into a spacious room. His muscles stiffened at the array of clothes. Was he expected to eat his meal lying down like a Roman? But after an awkward wait, he lowered his body gingerly and, imitating Joel, propped himself up on one elbow, aware of Thaisha's amusement. For all her airs, he could wager she had never seen a couch herself up to a month ago. No one in the village boasted such heathen nonsense. Joel's mother, with a gracious word, led her daughter behind a silken screen where they would both be hidden from view while the men of the family ate. More nonsense. Daniel was sure that in the village they must have sat on mats and eaten their meal together like any other family. Through the prolonged hand-washing, Daniel fidgeted, affronted by the silver pitchers, the fine tiny napkins, the hovering slaves. Then, at the sight of the food, a fierceness sprang up in him. He had drained every drop from the cup of date wine before he noticed that the others were holding theirs untouched. Too late, he set down what remained of his small loaf of bread. He had torn into it like Samson himself, and he saw Hezron's lips flatten together. Curse their finicky rules. Had they ever felt the gnawing of an empty stomach? "Your home?" Hezron inquired, after the scant portions of fish and fruit had been consumed in silence. "Is it far from Capernaum?" Daniel dragged his attention from his empty bowl. "In Ketzah, sir."
"Indeed," Hezron looked surprised. "Your father, too, I do not seem to recall."
"My father was Jamin, chief overseer of the vineyards."
"So," said Hezron, frowning, "I remember a very tragic affair. He was a good man, your father, but a rash one."
His cool tone pricked Daniel's thin skin and stirred the anger that always smoldered close under the surface. He glowered at his plate, holding his tongue. "You are the support of your mother?"
"My mother is not living, either."
Hezron hesitated. "You have been doubly unfortunate," he said in a kinder tone, mistaking Daniel's anger for grief.
"Do you follow your father's trade?"
"No. I was bound to Amalek, the ironsmith."
"Sold," he felt like shouting, "sold into slavery for a term of 6 years to a man who was not fit to own even a mule.
Had the rabbis protested then, or a single soul in the village lifted a finger to help him? Well, said Hezron reasonably, it is necessary for every boy to learn a trade. Joel, as you probably know, was trained as a sandal maker, as I was myself, though I must say I applied myself with more diligence. I do not seem to remember seeing you in Amalek's shop. I didn't work there long. You can tell he's a blacksmith, Joel broke in an effort to swerve his father's questions. With those muscles, you'd be a sensation in the gymnasium, Daniel. Have you ever been there? The Roman gymnasium? Daniel glared at his friend. I would never set foot in it. I should hope not, said Hezron, with a scowl at his own son. That was an ill-considered jest. Of course it was a jest, father, Joel amended hastily. It is not a matter for jesting, his father said. It is an outrage that some of our Jewish youths have been tempted to take part in these disgraceful games, and some of their elders even go to watch their shame. Well, there are other things in the city worth seeing, Joel persisted cheerfully. This afternoon, I'll take you about, Daniel. Daniel stared down at his empty cup. The morsels of food had not begun to whet his hunger. The rabbi had deliberately put him at a disadvantage with every question. His resentment turned now even against Joel. I have seen enough, he said rudely. All I can see is the Roman fortress and the eagles in the streets. Everywhere I turn, I hear the ring of Roman boots on the pavement. Joel, a worried line puckering in his forehead, still attempted to steer his friend to safety. I felt that way at first, he said, but you do get used to it. For the most part, they mind their own business. Some of them even try to be friendly. Friendly? Daniel reared up on his couch. This morning on the road I passed an old man mending the axle of his wagon. He was deaf and he couldn't hear the chariot coming. It caught his rear wheel. He said there was room and to spare. He swore the soldier meant to do it. His cabbages were ruined and the old man was shaking all over.
Can you get used to that? He glared across the table. Joel looked down, dismayed. Hezron spoke sternly. Unfortunate things happen, we know, he said, but your friend has doubtless found a market for his vegetables. We must remember that here in Capernaum we have reason to be grateful to the Romans for our beautiful synagogue. But Daniel had gone too far to retreat. The dark tides had swelled to the brink, flooding out politeness, caution, even the memory of the errand that had brought him to this house. A Roman synagogue, he growled, raised with Roman taxes. What is better than the stadium? Joel gasped. Hezron, his eyes flashing, rose from his couch. Watch your words, boy, he warned. The synagogue is a house of God, no less because Roman funds helped to build it. The boy also sprang to his feet. His dark eyes blazed back at the man. I would never set foot in it, he cried. There is blood upon it. The passion in his words trembled through the quiet room. Young man, Hezron's voice was like a whip, you will learn to keep your thoughts to yourself. If you have no concern for your own life, you will respect the safety of those who offer you hospitality. The stinging reminder restored Daniel to reason. A flush swept over his face. Forgive me, sir, he stammered. I was not ungrateful for your kindness, but I can't understand. Have the city people forgotten? They don't seem to care. Everywhere I look, I see them, their stupid faces, their armor clanking. How can you feel grateful to them, grateful that they built us a synagogue to keep us contented, that they let us breathe the air they have polluted? I shouldn't have come here. I don't belong in the city or in a house like this. I can't endure to go on as though nothing were wrong when my people are prisoners on their own land. He stammered to a stop, aghast at himself, and saw to his surprise that the man was no longer looking at him with scorn, but with something like pity. Hezron stepped around the table and laid a hand firmly on Daniel's shoulder. My boy, he said quietly, we have not forgotten. We feel as you do. In his heart, every Jew grieves at our captivity. We have need of patriotism like yours, but we have also need of patience. We must not say we cannot endure what God in his judgment has visited upon us. But how long must we endure it forever? God has not spoken his final word. Until he does, it is our part to endure. But, I know, you have been listening to the zealots.
They stir up foolhardy young men like you to fill their ranks. Daniel backed away, freeing his shoulder. The zealots are the finest men in Galilee. They are brave and honorable. Hezron stopped him. Many brave men have come out of Galilee, he said, but not many men of judgment. The zealots have thrown themselves against the conquerors time and time again, and what have they to show for it? Rows of crosses and burning villages and heavier taxes. They see a few Romans marching, a cohort, and the Roman power seems slight and open to attack. They do not think that behind these few there are others, another cohort, a legion, countless legions, on and on, as far as the mind can reach, all armed, all perfected in the art of killing. To a power that holds the whole world in its grip, what is a swarm of reckless zealots, buzzing mosquitoes to be silenced and forgotten? They, mark my words, boy, Israel has one great strength, mightier than all the power of Rome. It is the law, given to Moses and our fathers. When the last Roman emperor has vanished from the earth, the law will still endure. It is to the law that our loyalty must be devoted. I wish Joel to understand this, and I must forbid him to see any old friends who will turn his mind to violence. I ask you to go now at once.
Go in peace, Daniel, with a prayer that you may see the truth before that rash tongue of yours betrays you. But do not return. He motioned to a servant who stood near the door. Go with our guest and see that he is started on the right road. Joel made an impulsive gesture, swiftly checked and stood quietly, thoroughly silenced, too confused even to attempt a courteous leave-taking. Daniel flung back his head and followed the servant from the room. As the outer door shut behind him, all his rage was turned against himself. How could he have bungled his errand so stupidly? He had failed Rosh. Rosh would never trust him again, and why should he? He could not even keep his own head, and he had lost Joel. Yet beyond the humiliation of reporting his defeat to Rosh, he knew a sharper disappointment. He had lost not only a new recruit, he had lost something he had been close to having for the first time in his life, a friend of his own.